Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry, and you are joining us in the midst of a crisis which seems to be at a real historical turning point. The crisis in Ukraine and Crimea may be deceptively serious or deceptively of little consequence. At this fork in the road, we mean to examine this hour two very different perspectives on the crisis, help you to understand the traditional ethnic players on the ground in eastern Ukraine, and then look at the big power stakes, the U.S., Europe, and especially China, on the sidelines, uneasy sidelines, yet with crucial ties and investments that may make disengagement difficult over the next few weeks. We'll also focus this hour closer to home on your home and how the value of it may be the most important economic indicator for communities struggling to break free of the global recession. But we begin with the Russian perspective on this crisis. We turn now to Dmitry Babich. He's political analyst for the Voice of Russia Radio, joins me now from Moscow. Dmitry, welcome back to the program.
Yes, nice to hear from you.
So a couple of things. Let's begin with the idea that was reported fairly widely yesterday that it is widely assumed in Russia, according to polling, that what happened in Ukraine is being thought of as a terrorist takeover in Kiev. Do you believe that? And why do most Russians seem to believe that?
Well, I can tell you my impression. I not only traveled in Ukraine, but I also read in Ukrainian and in other languages the program documents of some of the parties now represented in the Ukrainian government. One of them is called Svoboda. But in the beginning of the 90s, it was called the National Social Party of Ukraine, a euphemism for National Socialist. These people write that they are Ukrainians are, I quote, anthropologically and culturally superior to Russians. And they say they are the successors of the Ukrainian nationalists who helped in 1941 Adolf Hitler to take hold of Ukraine, of Western Ukraine, fighting the Soviet troops there. We all know very well that a lot of these people later served in the concentration camps. You probably remember the Odyssey of John Demjanjuk, one of such people who was later deported from the United States to face justice. As a friend of mine in Kiev said, this revolution was anti-corruption, anti-authoritarian, but also anti-Russian.
But is that a pretext for massing Russian troops on the border of Crimea and actions which seem to speak about some sort of liberation of Russian-speaking people in Crimea by the Russian army, by, in a sense, annexing Crimea? Are you prepared to say that the Russians are not planning to do anything like this?
Well, he talked about protecting these people from some of the elements in the new government in Ukraine. And of course, if this government is, you know, includes the people whom I just described from the National Social Party of Ukraine, if one of its first laws is the abolition of Russian as a regional language in 13 Ukrainian regions with predominantly Russian population, of course, people in Crimea have reasons to be concerned. And that's why they supported the movement of troops, and there was not a single shot fired so far.
Although people we spoke with in Crimea yesterday say, Russian-speaking and Ukrainians, say that what they fear most is Russia getting involved and bringing Europe into this conflict and creating a much wider, much more escalated sense of violence throughout Ukraine. That's what they fear. They don't fear these extremist groups that you're talking about.
Well, I don't know which people you talk to, but I have a lot of friends in Ukraine, especially in eastern Ukraine. And why do you think we have now protest rallies not only in Crimea, but also in Donetsk, in Kharkiv? Why do you have people there putting Russian flags at various places? You know, they want to defend themselves from the new nationalist government in Kiev.
But Vladimir Putin also signed an agreement not to move troops into Ukraine, into Crimea. And it would appear that the movement of troops has violated that agreement on the surface. What does Putin say to that?
Well, actually, the troops which moved in Crimea, these were the troops which were stationed there at the base of the Black Sea Fleet, according to an agreement signed years ago you know, it was interesting today, Putin at this press conference, he said that when we described what happened in Kiev as a violent takeover of power, we hear in response that this is a people's revolution. Okay, Putin said, if it's a people's revolution, then it's a different country, just like the Soviet Union was a different country from the Russian Empire before 1917. If it's a different country, a revolutionary country, then the agreements that we have had with it are no longer valid.
So that is his basis for saying that he's followed international law in this, that basically the Ukrainian government has thrown out the rule book and we're starting from square one. So everything's legal.
All the sides here got out of the framework of the law. And in this situation, it's very difficult to say who started first and who is more at fault. But I would remind you that all of it started from a very minor problem. You know, Yanukovych just asked to postpone the signing of that association agreement with the EU. He didn't cancel it. He just wanted to postpone it. And then the EU got mad. You know, there was direct support for the insurgency in Kiev. And we are now with 10 times or 100 times greater problems than with this small, minor issue of the timing for signing an agreement with the EU.
Finally, Dmitry, would you say that Putin believes, that the Russians believe, and that you believe that the West has thrown in with anti-Semitic, anti-Russian extremists by supporting the protesters in Kiev?
Well, I think that John Kerry and Catherine Ashton and other Western diplomats, they should be more selective in the kind of people whom they shake hands with in Ukraine, with the kind of people that they support in Ukraine. So the truth is that this Ukrainian revolution was both anti-corruption and anti-Russian, and also partially even anti-Jewish.
Dmitry Babich is a political analyst for the Voice of Russia Radio, speaking to us from Moscow. Dmitry, thank you so much.
Thank you.
So what do the large number of Ukrainians and Ukrainian Americans in this country think of the situation in Crimea and of the divisions between Russia and Ukraine? Boris Potapenko is former president and current vice chair of the Ukrainian Congress Committee in Detroit. Boris, welcome.
Thank you.
What do you make of this language from Dmitry a moment ago about the kinds of people they shake hands with, referring to Secretary of State John Kerry, that the people running Ukraine right now are extremists, anti-Jewish, anti-Semites?
A U.S. representative to the United Nations yesterday characterized Russia's position on what's going on in Ukraine and who's in charge in Ukraine as black is white and white is black. And the Chancellor of Germany, Angela Merkel, characterized Mr. Putin's utterances as rather bizarre and that he has lost touch with reality. The fact that this canard about fascists, anti-Semites, nationalists is constantly being repeated by the Russian government and its fellow travelers around the world is really directed towards the Russian people. Because in the West, despite the drumbeat from Russia's associates or supporters in academia and media, the West has really come to understand that Maidan was a revolution for European values, that it was a revolution that was manned by different nationalities that call themselves Ukrainian citizens.
All right, Boris, but let's take the argument of Putin look at it from its political sort of power. Can he mobilize paranoid, fearful Russian-speaking people in Crimea and Ukraine by appealing to these, as you say, mad metaphors about anti-Semitism and fascism, and really deny the West an influence in this conflict?
No, he can't, because in Ukraine, the people live together. In eastern Ukraine especially, the Russian speakers are predominantly ethnic Ukrainians. Russians make up only 18% of the population, and there isn't a majority of Russians in any of the Ukrainian provinces. Moreover, the organized Jewish community in Ukraine is very upset with the use by Yanukovych and now by Putin of the term anti-Semitism to try to foment hostilities in Ukraine.
Can they he foment? Can he make good on that fomenting? In other words, can all this stuff be stirred up?
No, the only way he could do that is by introducing larger numbers of Russian agents in Ukraine, if not the army itself.
All right, let's talk about Western influence here. John Kerry arrived in Kiev proposing a $1 billion loan. Do you think that's enough, or is that a sort of paltry symbolic symbol at this point? The Russians already offered $8
billion. It's an important first step in a bridge loan for the transition government, so that in May, when the new government, the new president is elected and a new government is put in place, the IMF can renegotiate the repayment of its loan and introduce a new aid package. So right now, Ukraine needs a bridge loan for the next 3 months. That $1 billion is good towards a total of a $3 billion bridge loan at this time.
30 seconds, Boris. What are you most fearful of in the next coming days?
I'm very concerned that the 150,000 Russian troops, mobile offensive forces amassed along the eastern frontier of Ukraine, will cross into Ukraine. Russia really needs to make a decision whether it's made its point, or its point is to go back to 1921 when they invaded an independent Ukraine and started the whole process of five generations under Soviet rule.
Boris Potapenko is former president and current vice chair of the Ukrainian Congress Committee in Detroit. Thanks so much, Boris. The music there of Czech composer Leos Janáček, the orchestral suite Taras Bulba, named for a Cossack hero. In this Ukraine crisis, we're hearing about Cossacks and Tatars, ethnic Russians and Slavs, and let's give you a very quick historical context right now for these formerly exotic and now historically relevant terms. Let's take the Cossacks first. They are an ancient people of southern Russia and southern Ukraine who became a national movement, helping to free the Ukrainians from Polish rule in the 17th century. Then they were a movement that fought to constrain Russian encroachment in Ukraine and other Slavic lands in modern times, especially during the Soviet Union. And they have been Russian backers and Russian enemies down through history. It is Russian Cossacks who have thrown in with the ethnic Russians in Crimea in the current crisis. Then there are the Tatars, an ancient Muslim people associated with the city of Kazan. That history evoked here by Russian composer Mussorgsky in the piece you're listening to now, Siege of Kazan, from the opera Boris Godunov. In the 18th century, a large group of Tatars settled in Crimea. The Tatars were ruthlessly suppressed under the Soviet Union under Joseph Stalin, but eventually were granted their own Republic of Tatarstan, a republic that did not make it as an independent nation after the fall of the Soviet Union. And so as we listen to the classic Great Gate of Kiev from Mussorgsky's Pictures at an Exhibition, Kiev and Ukraine have become the center of numerous ethnic and political grievances against Russia and against the various movements that would confront Moscow right now. Keeping them all in focus will be the challenge for the West, if it means to have any influence in these ancient places. This is The Takeaway.